I'm going to start with really a simple example that I have classified as the annoying JavaScript trap example. And we got this example at the Internet Storm Center some time ago, and I don't quite know how the victim was lured to visit the website. Most likely it was a spam message that contained a link. And a lot of people like clicking on links. And so one of these persons clicked on a link, came to a website, and this is what they saw. So a screenshot of the website. So this was actually implemented as an animation. So it was flashing black and white. And also there was a catchy jingle playing in the background if your speakers were turned on. And the jingle went something like, you are an idiot. Ha 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 ha. So I actually encountered the same jingle in a different incident later, several years later. It was an MP3 file that was distributed by a network worm that would play this jingle on infected systems. And then I saw it yet again. If you search the web for "you are an idiot" MP3 file, you're actually going to find it at some site that gives out ringtones for phones. So apparently if there's a phone ringtone, if you want, you can get one of those MP3s. Anyway, so the victim clicked on a link. They saw this message. They said, oops, I guess I shouldn't have done that. Let me close this browser. When they closed the browser window, or they tried to close it, new windows appeared in its place. And every time the victim tried to close one of these browser windows, new windows kept appearing. So the victim got stuck. And every window that would appear, it would flash. And every window would play its own version of that same jingle. So after a while, the screen was overwhelmed with windows. The speakers were blasting this jingle. And the user had no choice but to shut down the system. So it looks like a denial of service type of attack, kind of an annoyance. But you know, let's say somebody in your organization was hit with an attack like this. And the question is it truly just a denial of service? Or maybe there's actually some real exploitation going on behind the scenes. Maybe this is all smoke and mirrors, and there's some really devious stuff going on behind the scenes. So as an analyst, let's say you get a URL that the victim clicked on, and now you need to understand what is the type of an attack. What's going on here? So once you have a URL, you would go there. And we're going to talk about how to visit a dangerous website shortly. Let's say you go there with your browser. You look at the source code of that site. Maybe you have JavaScript disabled so that it doesn't blast the song at you. And here is the source code of that website. Let's take a look at it. This is mostly HTML with some JavaScript embedded in it. So we've got the body tag. The body tag is HTML that defines the way the body of the page is going to look. For example, it says that the background color should be FFFFFF, which is white. There's also an event defined here that's a JavaScript event on unload. When the browser is unloaded, execute function procreate. Unload means that the victim is trying to close the browser window or navigate to another page. So whenever the victim tries to navigate away or close the browser window, the browser will call the function procreate. And procreate is defined further in the page using JavaScript. And here's what procreate does. It calls another function called openWindow 4 times. And openWindow accepts a parameter of open.html, and open.html is the actual page that you're looking at. And what does openWindow do? Well, it's defined further in the page. OpenWindow calls a JavaScript method window.open that opens a browser window. This is why whenever a victim tried to go away or close the browser window, 4 new windows appeared. Because procreate was called, it called openWindow 4 times, and it opened 4 new windows. And that's all that's going on here. It doesn't seem to be all that malicious. That's why I think it's just an annoying JavaScript trap example. But at its essence, this is what you're going through as an analyst, trying to understand the severity or the mechanics of a browser-based attack. Of course, there are more intricacies in other real-world attacks because looking at their code might be a bit more complicated if it's obfuscated. Whenever you have an incident that involves a malicious website, you need to know how to retrieve contents of that website so that you can analyze them. If you go there using a vulnerable browser, you yourself might get infected. So of course you got to take certain precautions. What I typically do is I use one of my laboratory systems. I connect my system to a network connection that's not officially affiliated with my organization so that the attacker can't easily track me. Let's say it's a DSL line. I use my virtual machine that I can easily revert if it gets infected, and I configure it to use the NAT mode. NAT mode in VMware is what allows a virtual machine to connect to the internet if you're plugged into the internet connection. So now I have my virtual machine that's able to browse websites. Rather than use a regular browser, I try to use a very, very simple browser that's less likely to get infected. And the simplest browser out there is probably wget. Because wget doesn't even try to render a page. All it does is it retrieves it and saves it locally. Not a lot of code, not a lot of rendering to do, no rendering, and therefore less likely to have a bug that's exploitable. You can use wget to retrieve a very specific page, or you can call it with a mirror mode to tell it to actually just mirror that whole website, copy as many pages as you can. And if you like the idea of mirroring a malicious website before it goes away, another tool that you might like is called HTrack Website Copier. It's an open source tool that's got a nice GUI, a lot of flexibility in allowing you to define how you want the website mirrored. Yes?
When your website got mirrored, does it include the banners and things of that nature or what?
So you're asking how much content is included when you mirror the site. Well, it depends on how sophisticated is the mirroring algorithm. And usually it will include the images. So like the banner pages, if they're hosted on that particular site. With HTrack Website Copier, you have the flexibility to tell it whether to go to other websites that might be referenced from this website. Sometimes it's nice to be able to mirror a site, but I find that I end up not doing it usually because it's too noisy. It doesn't get everything I want. So I end up just using wget to retrieve specific pages as I go through my analysis. Yeah, because you're right. Certain things it might not know how to get, especially if the code is dynamically generated using JavaScript on the client side. Be careful when visiting these malicious websites, because a lot of these websites will only allow you to connect once, and they will remember that you've connected there. And if you want to repeat your experiment, guess what? They've already blocked your IP address because they figure if you're a victim, it's enough for you to visit their site once. If you're coming back, you're up to no good. So most of the sites nowadays that I see, I can only go there once from a given source IP address. So you have a limited number of connection attempts. That's why you might want to have some proxies through which you can proxy your connections. Some people like using anonymizing proxies like Tor or Jandanim. That's another network that's similar to Tor that's not quite as well known. You, of course, don't want them to know what organization you're coming from, because then you'll know that you're trying to investigate them.
They don't know that you're coming from an anonymizer?
It's hard for them to know which IP addresses are associated with anonymizing networks, but I don't know. I suppose it's possible to list all of them. I do know that attackers, there have been several initiatives where attackers have tried to determine which IP addresses security researchers use and try to map IP addresses to antivirus labs. There has been an effort, several that I know of, where they purposefully shared with antivirus researchers malicious executables, knowing that the antivirus researcher or the malware researcher will grab one of those executables. And then they knew that he will infect one of his lab systems with it and allow the executable to connect outbound, and that's how they knew which IP address the researcher is coming from. So you gotta be careful. Don't expose your source IP addresses to attackers. Nowadays, it's not enough to simply say wget and give it the URL. You've gotta be more precise in how you retrieve that website. For example, most of these websites will look at the user agent string to determine what kind of a browser are you using, because they've got different exploits depending on your browser. If your browser is wget, they're probably not going to try attacking you. They'll know that you're a researcher. But wget allows you easily to define, using the user agent parameter, any user agent that you want to be. So in the examples on the slide, I've got Internet Explorer 7 as if it's running on Windows XP. the bottom of the slide, I've got an example where I've got a user agent string pretending to be Firefox version 3 running on Windows Vista. And in the notes to the slide, I've got a reference, I think, on page 95. Let me confirm that before I say this. Yeah, there's a reference to a website called wannabrowser.com. And that is a great resource for all the various user agent strings you may want to use. So there's a drop-down on wannabrowser.com that says which agent do you want to pretend to be, and it's going to generate the string for you. And you just copy and paste that string into wget if you don't quite know which user agent string you need to use. So wannabrowser.com is a good resource for this. Now, in addition to being able to spoof the user agent, you need to be able to spoof additional HTTP connection parameters. Another really important one to spoof is the referrer field. The referrer field tells the malicious website where you came from. And if your referrer field is blank, to them it's a little bit suspicious. A lot of the cases that I've been looking at, unless your referrer field is set to a specific website, they won't try to attack you. So let's say one of the victims in your organization says that I got infected when I went to example.com. And you say, okay, great, let me go there as well to see what's going on. You go to example.com yourself? Nothing malicious there. What is he talking about? Ah, it's because maybe the way your victim found himself on that website is because he Googled for some search term and he clicked on a Google search result. The malicious website looked at the referrer field, noticed that the victim is coming from Google and tried to attack him. But you as a researcher, if you don't know how to properly set your referrer field, the website won't try to attack you. So that's why nowadays when you interview your victims, it's not enough to just ask them, what website did you go to? It's not enough to just ask them, what browser were you using? You also need to ask them, where did you click? Did you Google for a particular search? Did you use Bing? Did you click on a link from an email? That's what you're going to have to replicate. Now, the easiest way that I found to replicate and to spoof all of those headers using wget is to use a file called wgetrc. And there's a file in Remnux that's already set up for you to pretend like wget is a real browser. You see, if a malicious website wants to be really careful, it's going to also expect you to have other headers, like the accept header and the accept language header. Most browsers set those headers. wget does not usually set those headers. So if you're just using wget, and if you're only spoofing user agent and referrer, the malicious website can still easily see that you are up to no good, because those other noisy headers aren't going to be set. So what I did is I created wgetrc file for you that sets all of the headers that a typical browser would set. Let me show you the full contents of the file. If you look at wgetrc on Remnux, you can see that I've specified several headers, like the accept language, accept encoding, connection keep alive, and user agent. I'm also defining refer here, and this is what a normal browser would set. So this file is pretty realistic representation of what the attacker would expect to see. If you don't know what to set the referrer field to, set it to be Google. That's the safest bet, because that's how a lot of attacks operate. And the referrer field that I have set in that WRC file pretends to be Google, although you may need to modify it to match a particular search term. This is a pretty generic string, but this is a good start. So if you use wget from Remnux, it's going to automatically use this config file and pretend to be a real browser. So I'm pretty happy about the setup. There's another tool that I thought I'd mention to you called curl. And in some cases, it's better to use curl than wget. There's a problem with wget, actually. Let's see. Here's an example of a site I was looking at. Yahoo-analytics.net. It was actually a malicious site. Now, people were saying that they were getting infected when they visited that site. But when I went there with wget, wget says, hey, page not found. What are you talking about? And when I first saw this, I thought that the malicious website is not there anymore. But that's because wget has this I wouldn't call it bug, but it has this limitation. If wget visits a website and the website presents a page not found, wget will not show you any content. But the thing about page not found is that it's still a web page, and that web page could still have malicious code embedded into it. But if you use curl with the dump header parameters, then if you go there with curl, and it's actually gonna dump full headers, and you will be able to see that that error page actually has a malicious iframe embedded into it. So I typically use curl rather than wget. What you see me doing here is that the curl retrieves the page, but the page is gzip compressed. You see the file command in Linux identifies the file type that curl retrieved for me. A web server can compress the web page that it gives you. Web browsers usually automatically decompress it, so you never notice that it was compressed. But for efficiency purposes, web browsers, web servers oftentimes compress the pages. If you use curl and you see that the page is compressed, no problem. You can decompress it using zcat, and then you can look at its contents. So if in doubt, use wget, fine. It's the most popular tool, but if you get an error, try curl. It might give you more information. And also curl can be configured just like wget. So if you look at that curl.irc file on Remnux, it is very similarly set up to also fake all of those headers that you want to be able to fake. So wget and curl, the way it's set up on Remnux, is going to save you some time, I think. Any questions about this, this concept of using curl or wget to connect to malicious sites? Yes. So yeah, absolutely. If you have network logs and you see what browser the victim was using and the headers that they had set, yeah, copy those headers, modify the curl.rc or wget.rc file on Remnux, and specify the specific headers that you're trying to mimic. Yeah, that file is meant to be edited. The configuration right now has some sane values, but you're welcome to modify it, of course. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Yes. Maybe I just get unlucky, but lately, whenever I go to a site, I retrieve it once, and I try to go to it a few minutes later, I'm blocked. But you're right, it's interesting because, in a corporate world, everybody's NATed, so you could have a thousand users look like they're coming from a single IP address. I guess it depends on the kind of attack that they have. If they're targeting all of the internet, then the likelihood that they're gonna get two users from the same corporation, let's say 10 minutes, is relatively small, and they'd rather err on the side of caution. So maybe there's some kind of a timeout where I'm blocked for, I don't know, 30 minutes, let's say. But lately, I have been getting blocked, yeah. And I don't think it's because they figured out my IP address, because I keep changing it. Another tool that I think is very useful to help you analyze malicious websites is a web proxy. And I'm talking about a local proxy running on your own system. And the reason I think it's useful is because when you analyze a lot of these websites, most of the malicious code is not just on a single website in a single page. No, no. You've got one page referencing three other pages, and those three pages reference three other pages. So you got this code distributed across the web. And sometimes it's hard to be able to figure out, well, which page resides where, and how do I grab all of them? So here's what I like to do. I use a tool, Peros HTTP proxy. It's a proxy that runs locally on my Windows workstation. And I configure my Internet Explorer or Firefox browser. Instead of connecting directly to the internet, I configure it to connect to localhost where I'm running this proxy. And then I might use my browser to just click around the malicious website. And the browser will retrieve all the necessary pages that the attacker set up for me to attack me. And the nice thing about a tool like Keras is that it's going to record my full browser history, and it's going to save all the web pages that the browser retrieved. So it gives me a pretty good audit trail of where the browser went. Not because I typed that URL, but because the pages that the browser loaded made references to other pages. So in the example on the screen, I think I was investigating some kind of a phishing site that was pretending to be Bank of America, and I just wanted to see, is this plain old phishing, or is there any kind of exploitation going on behind the scenes? Another really nice reason to use a tool like this is because Paris allows you to track requests and responses. What this means is that you can configure Paros so that whenever a browser tries to connect to the malicious website, before the request is sent to the website, you can review it here and modify it if you want. Similarly, when a website responds, before the response reaches your browser, you will see it on the screen first, and you can actually edit it if you want. So if you see the malicious website is trying to attack you, you can try to defang the attack. You can try to eliminate the code that you think is going to just bother you and you don't want to see. So it gives you a lot of control regarding how your browser visits the malicious website. The one thing, if you use Paros, by default, it'll modify user agent to say, hello, I am Paros. You don't want to tell the malicious website that you're using Paros. On Windows, this is a program written in Java, and if you're using it on Windows, all you got to do is invoke it from the command line using the no user agent string. And if you do this, Paros won't override user agent. I also have Paros installed on Remnix, and that one is configured to not do this by default. So if you use it on Remnix, you're going to be okay. Yes. So you're asking, can you pipe the output of this to a file instead so you can examine it later? As far as I have seen, this particular tool is an interactive GUI tool. You can save what it captures. You can save it all to a file, but I don't believe there's a kind of a batch mode where it can run from the command line. Not that I have seen. But there are some other tools like this. Another popular one is WebScarab. WebScarab maybe will let you do some scripting from the command line. I'm not sure. My favorite one is Paros, and I like its interactivity. It allows me to get a good visibility into how my browser reaches the remote website.
Can you try Temperdata?
Temperdata is a plugin for Firefox, and it lets you do something very similar. So if you're analyzing a website using Firefox, Temperdata is a Firefox add-on that's great for stuff like this. This is generic, because it works for any browser.
Mm-hmm. That's just HTTP traffic.
This is only HTTP, and it can support HTTPS traffic as well. Yeah. Now, realistically, most malicious websites that you're going to be analyzing now won't show you their code in plain text. They will be obfuscated. So for analyzing malicious websites, you need to be aware of the obfuscation techniques, and of course, you need to know how to bypass them. And that's what I wanted to show you. And to get us started, I'm going to show you perhaps the first type of an obfuscation technique. You don't see it very often, but I'm going to introduce you to this technique because it shows you where we started so that you can see where we are now. You see, Microsoft recognized that a lot of legitimate developers are creating their fancy websites and they want to protect their intellectual property. They don't want the user to simply go view source code and now they can see how they've implemented this wonderful, beautiful website. So Microsoft created this obfuscation engine called JScript Encode. And Internet Explorer has a built-in deobfuscation engine. So if you're a developer and you're creating a website that's going to be rendered in Internet Explorer, you can download a free tool from Microsoft and you can encode all of your scripts. These scripts are going to look like gibberish to you if you look at their source code, but Internet Explorer has a built-in deobfuscation mechanism, and it will be able to render them properly. How do you know you're dealing with those encoded scripts using Microsoft's tool? Well, if you look at the source code, and the language is jscript.encode, and the script looks like gibberish, that means it's encoded using this tool. But not to worry, because somebody reverse engineered the algorithm and created a wonderful script decoder utility. It's a command line tool. All you gotta do is you just parse the encoded script using this tool. It's gonna deobfuscate it. So if you see it, not to worry. There's a deobfuscation tool called script decoder utility. Here's an example of where this technique was used. And I keep it in this course even though it's dated to 2004, because in my mind, summer of 2004 was a really important summer in the development of malware. And in my mind, that is the summer where spyware became a really big problem. Before that summer, if you talk to antivirus companies and you would tell them, hey, we're worried about spyware, all these add-ons being installed into our users' browsers, AV companies would kind of snub you. They'd say, spyware, we're antivirus companies. We worry about viruses and worms and Trojans. Spyware is this nuisance that we don't really deal with. And so as a result, a lot of little startups started appearing trying to fight the spyware problem. But in the summer of June, in the summer of 2004, around May, there was a big vulnerability found in Internet Explorer, and Microsoft took like a couple of months to fix it. And it was a problem because everybody had an exploit to this vulnerability. So for about a month and a half, attackers had free rein on infecting Internet Explorer users. And a whole lot of people got infected. And they got infected with spyware. And so many people got infected that antivirus vendors started to acknowledge that it's a big problem and started buying up all these anti-spyware companies. So nowadays, if you get an antivirus tool, chances are it's got a pretty good anti-spyware component to it, and I think it's traced back to summer of 2004. And so if you were analyzing those attacks, you would notice that a lot of those malicious websites that were targeting these vulnerabilities, this is how they looked. JScript.encode is Microsoft's obfuscation method that was used against Microsoft's browser. Have no idea what this says, but if you use the decoder, the command line tool, you run it from the command line, and it'll decode the script, and it'll give you something that resembles the original JavaScript. And now, if you know how to read JavaScript, you can actually analyze the script and see what it does. So I'm not showing you the full script, just an excerpt from it. So, good to know. If you do happen to come across it, there is a decoder available to you, but realistically, you rarely see this nowadays. Nowadays, attackers use different, more sophisticated methods of obfuscating their scripts, and that's what I wanted to show you next. The obfuscation methods that attackers use nowadays, I think of them as native techniques in that they use JavaScript itself to obfuscate JavaScript, rather than relying on a third-party obfuscator that's built into a browser. What do I mean by this? Well, here's an example. This is an example of a malicious website called, the page is called script.html. I got a copy of it on your DVD because we're going to play with it in our lab. If you look at this script, what does it do? Well, there is a variable called arr, and this variable is very long. It contains a long, long string, much longer than what I was able to fit onto this slide, so I just cut it a little. So there's this big, long variable. And then there's a bit of JavaScript. There's a function called markCounter. And what does it do? Well, we don't quite know. This is what a modern obfuscated script typically looks like. How do we handle it? Well, let's think about the way a browser would deal with this. Because what you're looking at now, JavaScript that's obfuscated, is actually very similar at its core to the way traditional packed executables work. So let's think about it. In a traditional packed executable, you have the original program compressed and encoded and stored as data in a brand new executable. It's the same thing that's happening here. You have the original attacker's script encoded, and it's stored as data in a variable called arr, r. This is where the original script is hidden. In the traditional packed executable, you've got clear text assembly instructions that know how to unpack the original code. The same thing in JavaScript. Somewhere here, there are regular JavaScript instructions that are readable to you, but are hard to understand, that know how to take the data and decode the original script from within that data, just like a packed executable would. So when this page loads within the browser will execute the script, and the script will deobfuscate the original script. Now, in a traditional unpacked executable, once the unpacking finishes running, what's next? Well, remember we saw a jump to the unpacked code. You unpacked the executable, now you jump there to execute it. The same thing in an obfuscated script. Once deobfuscation runs, the next thing that the script needs to do is actually execute the deobfuscated script. How does JavaScript do that? The most common way is to use a command eval. So there is no jump, there is no call, there is eval. You're evaluating, you're executing a script that is stored, in this case, within a variable called txt. So whenever you look at these obfuscated scripts, you typically look for eval. There are other ways. Eval is one of the more common ones. So this is how an obfuscated script looks like, and this is how it works. Now, how do we bypass its protection? Well, here's an approach. How about we allow the script to run in our lab? The browser will know how to deobfuscate the script because it's going to know how to execute this algorithm. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at the contents of the variable txt, because in it, there will be the deobfuscated script. How are we going to do that? Well, here's how we started doing this before we had specialized tools. Before we had specialized tools to do this kind of stuff, what we would do is we would take that obfuscated script, save it locally, and then edit it. You would edit it, and you would comment out eval, // means comment it out, don't execute this instruction. And before eval, we would insert several instructions saying document.write. Document.write simply writes something into the browser's window. What are we writing? Well, we are writing out contents of txt into the browser so that we can look at them. This way, when the browser executes this page, it's going to execute the deobfuscation algorithm, and then it's going to write out contents of txt into the page. But here's a problem. When it writes out contents of txt into the page, it's going to then try to execute it as a script. So we end up still infecting ourselves. That's why we include txt within text area tags. Text area just displays it as text and does not allow the browser to execute it. So this is what we would do. It's a little bit awkward because it requires you editing this page. It's easy to make a typo. Also, what attackers started to do is they started including within their malicious script as the very first string a preemptive closing of the text area tag. So when we printed this to the browser window, the first tag was close text area. And when the browser saw that, it still ended up evaluating contents of txt. Anyway, there's a better way to do this. And the better way involves using a plugin for Firefox called Firebug. Firebug is a debugger for Firefox. And let me show you why it makes this relatively painless to do. I got instructions for this in your books. I'm going to show this to you first, and then I'm going to give you some time to do this in your lab. This work we're going to do completely in Remnex. I'm going to exit my IRC server because I don't need it anymore. So if you look in Remnex, one of the directories in there is going to be called malware. And in malware, there's malware that's on your DVD. I already copied it into Remnex. And we're in day two, so you got a CD to day two. And that's where you'll find the malware samples that we're going to be analyzing today. This particular exercise that I'm showing you now is within script.zip. So I CD'd into malware day two, and then I'm going to unzip contents of script.zip. I got instructions for this in your book on page 113. All right. Now, I've got this page, script.html, locally. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to load it into a browser. I'm using Firefox for this. So, I'm going to load Firefox script.html. I got Firefox installed on Remnex. Here we go. Now, Firefox that's installed on Remnex, I installed a couple of plugins into it. One of the plugins is the NoScript plugin. NoScript. Why did I do this? Because I wanted to disable JavaScript support by default. You see, now I feel relatively safe loading this malicious page into my Firefox because scripting is disabled. That's good. Remember how when we used OliDebug, we loaded a file into OliDebug, and it would pause the execution of the program to give us a chance to set our breakpoints. That's what I'm trying to mimic in Firefox. So I loaded the page into Firefox, but you see scripting is currently disabled, and now I can set my breakpoints.